Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
One and all, and welcome to Book Off, the literary podcast with a difference. I'm Joe Haddo, and wherever you are in the world, it's great to have you with us. And if you happen to be in the UK, well, I hope you're staying warm and indeed dry at the moment. Joining me in the studio this week are two fabulous authors who'll be going head to head in a war of the words. A little later on, my first guest is a Sunday Times bestselling author whose novels have been translated into more than 30 languages. Her debut, The Flatshare, sold over a million copies, and her second novel, The Switch, has been auctioned for a film by, now, some little-known director, Steven Spielberg's company, I think. Here to tell us about her fourth novel, The No-Show, it's Beth O'Leary. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
It's an absolute pleasure to see you again after so long.
I know.
And my second guest is another Sunday Times bestselling author, as well as being a podcaster and internet oversharer, her words. She worked as a children's book editor before writing her first novel, I Heart New York, and moving to Brooklyn, as you do. Her other novels include On a Night Like This and One in a Million, as well as the brilliant children's book series Cinders and Sparks. And here to tell us about her latest seasonal novel, The Christmas Wish, it's Lindsay Kelk. Hello to you.
Hello. Thank you very much for having me.
Welcome, both of you. It's so lovely to be here in person. You know each other, don't you? You've done an event together.
We have.
We hung out in Guildford last week, was it last week? I don't know why I'm asking Lindsay what day it was.
Lindsay doesn't know.
The poor woman's been everywhere in the last 10
Lindsay's
days.
Lindsay's delirious, will be referring to herself exclusively in the third person and
always a good sign.
Doesn't know where she is. But yes, we were in Guildford, absolutely, certainly, that definitely happened. I remember there being a train.
Yes.
Yeah, and you spoke and audience clapped.
So
sounds good. So there's, formal introductions have been done. And on top of just being mad busy, Lindsay, being over here and touring this book, you've come over from Los Angeles, is that right?
Yes. I live in LA now.
So a bit of jet lag potentially as well, in the mix?
I was claiming jet lag for some time. I think at this point I'm just tired. I don't think I can claim jet lag anymore. I think now it's been 2 weeks. I think this is officially just a bit tired.
You've moved past what could be counted as claiming jet lag.
Straight through. Absolutely.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you both here. And for the next 30 minutes or so, we're going to talk about your brilliant books. We're going to talk about your writing, get some book recommendations from you as well. And also, we'll do the book off, of course, where each of you gets 3 minutes uninterrupted, if you so wish, to use them to pitch as a book that you love and think we should all read. We'll get to that, though. Firstly, here's the thing about publishing a Christmas book, Lindsay.
Yes.
You have to talk about it in November and possibly even in October and maybe even in September.
Yes. And you have to write it all the months of the year, which is foolish.
Are you sick of Christmas?
No, I love Christmas. Thankfully, gratefully, I love Christmas. So it's all right by me. I've spent a lot of the last 6 weeks screaming, "No, it isn't too early," at people who don't really understand how publishing works. Like, I've got to talk about it. It's coming out.
We pointed out, me and my wife were in the car recently, and we pointed out 3 Christmas trees, I think, down one road that we
saw
already.
Excellent. There you go.
And that's mid-November. A bit early for me, but, you know, each to their own. So, yes, this book is a seasonal book, and it's the central character is Gwen Baker. Why don't you just tell us about her and set up her story for us?
So I'm notoriously terrible at pitching my own books, but I will attempt to do this after talking about it nonstop for 2 weeks. And I'm going,
I thought you would have had loads of practice now.
I should have. Yeah. That's true. Yeah. But no, basically what we do is bribe other authors to come on tour and do it with me, like Seth. We meet Gwen at the beginning of the book, and she is a high-flying British London lawyer, leaning right into those Hallmark tropes, you know, high-flying London lawyer coming home for Christmas to a little snowy country village with her family. She is recently single, broken up from what she thought was a perfect relationship. She's having some trouble at work, not to give any spoilers about the job situation. And she usually loves Christmas, but this year she is just not in the mood for it. She doesn't want to go. She doesn't want to deal with the family. She doesn't want to deal with everything that's happened to her over the course of the year. And to make a, you know, relatively long story, because you're paying for it, so the book short, she has the worst Christmas she could possibly have. Everything she thought could go wrong does go wrong. At the end of the day, she goes to bed and she's like, well, at least that's done. At least tomorrow I wake up and today is done. But surprise, surprise, she wakes up and it's Christmas Day again. And Gwen is trapped in a time loop. She finds herself trapped in Christmas Day, reliving the same Christmas Day over and over. She comes to realize someone in her family has made a wish, and that she has to try and grant that wish without knowing who it was and what the wish was. And the only bright spark in the day for her as she goes on is her childhood crush, the boy next door, Dev, is also home for Christmas, for the holidays, and she gets to spend time with him. But there are two problems there as well. One is he's engaged to someone else, and two is he doesn't know that they're seeing each other and over. He sees her anew every day. So she finds herself in this very difficult predicament, and I swear to God it's funny. Because the pitch is just like, well, that sounds terrible.
No, I can confirm it is funny.
Also, I thought it was a pretty good pitch, Beth.
Thank you. This is the last thing I'm doing on this tour, so it should be.
I think it's pitch perfect. So well done, Lindsay. You nailed it.
Thank you.
And it is very funny, I can attest to
that.
Thank you. And Beth. And the no-show, Beth, obviously came out a bit earlier this year. I think it was spring, wasn't it, that came out? Paperback in February.
Correct.
Also makes a very good Christmas present anyway. Doesn't matter what time of year it's out. Introduce us to Siobhan, Miranda, Jane and Joseph, and set up this story for those that haven't got to the book yet.
Yes, so the No Show is about Jane, Siobhan and Miranda, who are all stood up on the very worst day to be stood up, Valentine's Day. And as we sort of follow their lives, so Jane's kind of very softly spoken, bookish volunteer at a charity shop. Miranda's a kind of very outdoorsy, kind of loyal, guileless tree surgeon. And Siobhan is a very outspoken life coach. They each let this man back into their lives, because it transpires they've all been stood up by the same man. And he has some sort of secret, which we need to kind of unravel as the novel goes on. So it's kind of part rom-com, part mystery, I would say.
Yeah. Yeah, it is.
Was fun.
And it's funny.
Yes, so thank
this
you.
Seconded. But both of you, the humour comes from your, you know, the character situations in some ways. And it's always, as we read the books, both of your books, we're sort of like, we're really with them, we're feeling for them, but then we're also sort of laughing a bit as well at the ridiculousness of some of it. Question for both of you. Do you go in trying to find the humour, or do you sort of write what you want to be the plot and then have to sort of, I guess, make it funny?
I find humour, if it doesn't come in the first draft, it's so hard. Like, for me, it has to, that part should feel very easy. And if my least favourite edit that I leave for myself in the margin is make this bit funnier.
Right.
Because it's so hard. Like, just be funny. Go on, be funny. Whereas, you know, when it flows, and for me, it's so often about getting inside the character's head. And when you know the characters really well, like, my characters are funny. So it's easy. I don't have to be funny. They're doing it for me, you know. That's how it feels to me.
Yeah. Similarly, worryingly, this is going to be, I worry, a theme for today, is Beth and I might have the same brain. We found this out last week. But yeah, same thing. I love writing the comedy in, and it is exactly the same thing, whereas I will leave a note for my editor saying, I will make this funnier. And that is the most ridiculous thing to say, because it's the most subjective thing being funny is what one person finds funny, one person doesn't. So saying, I don't think this is funny enough. Also, that's the thing I think I hold myself to the highest standard of, is trying to get a laugh. I've spent my whole life trying to get a laugh. So if I don't think a joke is funny enough, I do have to go back and do it again. But it will drive me mad until it is right.
Until it's landing, basically.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then when you're, you know, when you've read the book like 100 times... Yeah. Obviously, it's not funny anymore.
Nothing's funny.
And I often actually delete my, like, the more jokey parts on an edit. And sometimes my editors will say, like, can we put this bit back in? Yeah. Like, I just thought it wasn't funny anymore. Same. Like, you need to give me a ha-ha in the margin. Otherwise, it's going.
Absolutely. Yeah. And the more stressed I am, the more jokes I'll throw at it. So then when I come back, I think, what was wrong with you? Like, what was actually wrong with you here? Take some of these out. But exactly the same thing. They're like, oh, there were some jokes we noticed had gone out. I'm like, what? Well, we'll just pop those back in
then. Yeah, okay. It's an amazing new autobiography memoir by Matthew Perry that's just recently been published. Mm-hmm. And amongst the many things he talks about in it, one of the things is how he, on the set of Friends, just always had to have the laugh. And if if a line didn't land or an audience didn't laugh as much as he sort of thought, that would ruin the rest of his day. You know, that would be like, you know, and he'd just think, oh, I'm not funny, I haven't got it, I haven't, you know. But actually, it comes back to that point of a line in a book, for example, or on a TV show can make some people laugh and not others. And then a line you might put in and throw away in there could have readers howling. And you just don't know, do you? That's the thing.
Yeah, it's one of the weirdest things I think about writing, and especially on this book in particular, because the reviews are starting to come in now, and like you reader reviews, which are the most terrifying ones, because they love tagging you in them, and then you get to see them all and you feel amazing about yourself or not. But they're so different, they're like poles apart. Some people are reading it and they're saying, oh, I loved the family dynamics, and I thought it was this really beautiful story about family and finding yourself and working out who you are through who your family is. And then the completely other end, they're like, oh, like totally cheesy Christmas movie in a book, this is hilarious. And I'm like, how is it both things? But apparently it's
both things.
And I think you write what you think it is, and then it stops being yours. And then they're both right. Both of those reviews are right. Mm. And I can't tell them which one it is, which is wild.
Well, also, I think that's a good thing.
I guess so.
I think so.
I mean, as long as no one's saying hated it 1 star, then I think we're all right. As long as they have an opinion, I'm happy.
And what were the initial reactions like when you said, oh, I'm doing a Christmas Groundhog Day?
I was far too confident about it. Honestly, I thought, ha-ha, this will be fun and easy. I love Christmas. And Groundhog Day, you don't have to come up with anything. You just keep doing it. Also, I was under the influence of quite heavy painkillers because I'd had a sinus surgery, I've told this story. So it's, shame. No one stopped me, which was the bad thing. I'd had a sinus surgery. I was on painkillers going to the hospital for a checkup. And I Wish It Could Be Christmas Every Day came on. We were listening to Christmas music. And I was like, oh, that's a good idea. Let's steal that. And I emailed my editor and was like, this might be the Vicodin talking, but... And she was like, no, let's do it. And she set herself up for just a world of pain because it was the hardest book I've ever written and the hardest edit. And Beth was the first person to say to me, this must have been really hard. Like, it was so hard.
It was masterfully done.
But how very kind.
That's so interesting that you picked up on that, Beth, because I wouldn't have said that. But then that just shows that you've made it But like, it's funny that you've gone, oh no, I know what she's gone through here.
I think it's just that if I came up with that, I would have, if I'd come up with that idea, I would have gone through the exact same thing. I would have gone, this is brilliant. I'm a genius. This is going to be amazing. And then you actually have to then do it. And the actual doing it, you know, novels are long.
Life in general, you come up with an idea and then you have to do it. And then, I mean, that's one of my biggest problems, is getting about my day.
But I mean, it's a really hard concept to pull off.
It's because I just hadn't thought about it. I was like, oh, it'll be so fun. And I love, obviously, Groundhog Day, and I love Palm Springs, and I love Russian Doll and all those. And I'm like, oh, this is going to be so fun. But then I realised that they are all visual gags. Yes. And Groundhog Day is a visual gag. You see the same thing and you see him just become increasingly unhinged and just start to unravel. And that's so hard to do in a book because it's not visual, it's writing. And you can't, you've got to keep the storyline moving forward, but you are trapped in the same location. Like, there's massive constraints by saying it's Christmas Day up north, weather's bad. How far can she go? Where can she go? You're trapped with the same characters. you can have character development to an extent, but they have to wake up the same day and go back to the beginning. It was so stupid. I was so stupid. But I was very proud at the end. But I was really pleased when Beth said that, because I said the same thing when I read her book. I think I emailed you and I was just like, you're very clever and I hate you. Because, without spoilers, there's timey-wimey stuff in your book too that was just so massively done and so cleverly unravelled, and you drop breadcrumbs, and when you know, but it was so beautiful to just be carried away by the story. I think it's really hard to mess with time. That's what I'm going to say.
That's what we've all learned. It's really hard to mess with time, whether you're writing it or living it.
Yes.
And did you find, Beth, this one, book four, easy now, I've got this, or was this not as easy perhaps as one would think?
No, this was not. I would say for me, hardest book to write was my second book, The Switch. And I think that's such a common writer's story, isn't it? Of the tricky second album. And then my third book, The Road Trip, was just, it was like, it was a beautiful writing experience. It was one of those, I was like heady with it. I couldn't think about anything else. I'd like the characters, I'd hear a song and it would just be about my book. And it was, everything. And it was beautiful. And I think I just had that release from having done the second one. Mm. And then I set myself a real challenge with the fourth book. And I think maybe got cocky. I was like, I can do this. It's fun now. This did really stretch me, this book. And I'm incredibly proud of it. It's definitely my most ambitious novel. But I had to plan a lot, just because the way the three stories play out, I couldn't kind of hold it all in my head.
Are you usually a pantster?
I am. I'm kind of, or a little bit of, I tend to do a couple of plans as I go along, which is sort of just dump a load of stuff that's in my head on a page and then don't really look at it again. Mm. But the process of sort of sketching it out briefly helps me. But with this one, I had a spreadsheet with the little coloured boxes and everything. And I wasn't sure about it as an approach, but actually I needed to do it. And what I think I worried about is that it would squash the characters, because I'm a very character-led writer. I tend to sort of, if a moment isn't feeling like what the character would do, I would always change the plot rather than make the character. Do you see what I mean?
Fit the character into the situation. Yeah.
And so I was sort of worried about how that would work, but it did. I kind of, they sort of grew within that structure. And writing this book, I basically had about 70,000 words, I had a total bolt from the blue idea that made sense of the whole book, and had to go back to the beginning and rework it. So it kind of had two giant spreadsheets anyway. So once you've realised that, you can make a plan and completely redo it anyway, that it does feel less restrictive. That is a positive spin on deleting about 70,000 words.
I love it. You've actually come to terms with it. You've been able to sort of
It's easy to
say,
if you'd asked me a year ago, it might not have been so...
You've gone through all the stages now.
Totally.
I'm acceptance.
I remember talking to Elizabeth McNeil, who said when she was writing her second novel... it was the second novel, I think. So after the Doll Factory, her cat somehow deleted her whole manuscript.
No.
Yeah. And again, it wasn't finished, but probably 80,000, maybe 70,000, and it had gone. And she was like, I don't know how the cat did it, but it turned out that it was the best thing that could have happened. So she says, now whether she just was reframing this or not, but basically, she said it wasn't working what she was writing, and actually that clean break made her reassess and kind of go, well, actually, if I don't have to write that one anymore, because it's gone.
Yeah.
Wow.
And she ended up going in a bit of a different direction, and it all worked out for the better. So yeah,
but
reframing.
That gave me chills when you said that.
I know.
It's the stuff of nightmares.
I immediately thought about my cats. I'm like, how much do I love them? How attached am I to my cats? Oh my God.
Yeah. Brutal. Haven't ever had not necessarily with a cat, but you haven't ever had one of those experiences then, Lindsay?
I did. I got quite far down the path with a book once.
Once
upon a time. And it just wasn't working. It just wasn't. And it was really hard to say, I'm not going to do this. Because it's weird. Being a writer is weird because your publisher is your boss, but they're your collaborator. And it's just a very strange feeling to go in and be like, hello, I know I said I was going to do this and now I'm not. And it was just a very difficult thing for me personally to say. Also, to admit defeat was really hard.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah. But for any writer, surely. Also, when you've got so far in.
Yes. Yeah. But it ended up being the best thing again. Yeah. It was wrong. It wasn't going to work. Yeah. I would have spent so much time trying to beat it into shape. And then what I did next, I loved. So, yeah, but that was a very unpleasant learning experience, which I do not care to repeat.
No, we'll forget about it now.
Cats are locked out the office from today
from
on. Yeah, oh my God.
So has Spielberg been on the phone, Beth?
It's been an exciting time. I mean, I the Flatshare TV show's out on the 1st of December.
Oh, the 1st of December as well, is it?
Just to, talk about screen
things. Oh, my God.
I didn't even mention that one. I know, I'm having a very whirlwindy time, actually. It is very exciting.
How involved in the Flatshare TV show were you?
Not really. Right. So it was a real... it's so strange. You kind of hand over your thing that, you put so much of yourself into. Mm. And actually, I wanted to do it that way because I think I would have been very all or nothing with this one because it was... I think if I'd got involved, I would have been so meddlesome. I would have been like, when is this bit in there? And are you going to do it? And actually, I really wanted Rose Lewinstein, she wrote the adaptation. I wanted her to have like the freedom of, the full creative freedom on it. And thankfully, she's done a brilliant job.
But these people know what they're doing, don't they?
We forget. Totally. And, but I didn't really realise how nervous I was about it until I got sent the first episode. And I thought, about 10 minutes into it, I just felt my body just relax.
Oh,
I was like,
good
thank
feeling.
God, I actually like it.
And it's 1st of December on...
Paramount Plus.
Right. Fantastic.
Yes, I know. Exciting times.
So exciting, isn't it?
But yeah.
Oh, and Spielberg can wait then. Do you know what I mean?
But it is a very surreal feeling to see kind of, you can't really get your head around it. I think this basically a lot with everything that's happened with my books is I can't quite sort of connect the story that I, particularly with the Flatshare, with this little story that I wrote on the train in the hope that somebody might read it, with all the stuff that's happened. And, you saying at the beginning, like, over a million copies, like, that's obviously not a thing you can hold in your head. So, but you get little glimmers, little moments where you do. And there was a real moment when we had a press screening for the Flatshare, when I saw, like, adapted from the novel come up on the screen, and it really got through. And I thought, this has happened. Yeah, amazing.
What a feeling. What, any adaptations in the pipeline for you, Lindsay?
I always feel like I don't know what you're supposed to say,
yes,
what you can and
what
can't
you
talk
say,
about.
What can't you say?
But yes, there's some stuff in the works, in development, a couple of things, she says, making noises. but unlike Beth, who is a sensible person, I am an actual monster who is supposed to be adapting it. And now I'm like, I've made a terrible mistake. But yeah, I'm working on
it. Is that the first
one
that you would be doing?
Yes, yeah. Mm. Yeah.
I don't think it's not a terrible mistake.
It's not, but I am an absolute control freak, so we'll see. We'll see.
Do you think you'd be able to change things? I think that's, if I'd been doing it myself, I think I would have struggled with making changes.
Yeah, I think so. At this point, I think yes, because I have seen obviously a lot of friends go through it. And before I was an author, much like Beth, I worked in licensed children's publishing.
Yes.
So I worked on film and TV tie-ins. So It's sort of going the opposite way. So I would sometimes take a script and write it and turn it into a novel. So I've done that a few times. And now I'm going the other way, taking a novel and turning it into a script. And I'm not precious about it. That's the other thing.
Okay, that's probably good.
Yeah, I think it is possible to be like, but this one moment was really important to me. But I do know that something that works on the page might not work on the screen. So I'm trying really hard to be, if anything, I've been too ruthless, apparently. I've been a little bit too brutal. I'm like, nope, take that person out. Sod them. Get them out. That moment doesn't work anymore.
They don't deserve any screen time.
Screw that person. It's a really weird experience. It's really strange because it's almost like you're adapting someone else's work.
And it's a bigger team, isn't it? Because, authors are so used to working quite solitary, and then you've got your agent, you've got your editor, and a bit of a wider team in the publisher, but like, that's it then.
Yeah.
Whereas, I know I've spoken to authors who have adapted work before and got, I've got like 20 people on a Zoom, 50 people on Zoom. I've got to email it to all these people because they've all got to have a say. It's a bit like...
Yeah, it's very strange. I was listening to this very podcast when you had Alex that wrote The Maidens on, and he said something that I found incredibly helpful, which is that he said that novels are about expansion and screenplays are about contraction. I was like, oh my God, that is the most useful thing I've taken because this is the podcast all the authors want to be on.
That's what they say.
That's what they say. That's what I've heard.
That's what I've heard.
And I found that incredibly useful, and I've carried that with me all the way through this.
Oh, that's so lovely. That's so great to hear. I mean, genuinely, actually.
I thought about messaging him, and I'm like, no, that'd be weird. He doesn't know you. He doesn't care.
But I think
if he gets
should.
This back, like, if he gets this back, hey, then they're like,
maybe no. Alex is a listener too, and maybe he'll reach out to you now after this. Before I ask you about what you've been reading and enjoying recently, which I always like to ask my guests, and always put them on the spot, and then I see panicked faces from across the table going, I'm pretty sure I did read something this year. I want to ask, because we're sort of in, you know, tipping into the festive period, and we have this lovely book here, Lindsay.
Yes.
What are your favourite things about Christmas?
Oh, I love Christmas. I've always loved Christmas. I'm always trying to work it out. And with this book, it was really weird to drill down into what I love about Christmas. And it then all made me reflect on what Christmas means to everybody. She says, doing another pitch for the book. But a big part of it ended up being what Christmas means to everyone in the family. And my version of Christmas is that I'm the baby of the family and a spoilt little monster who would just sit on the settee and eat chocolate and be ferried around and given presents. And then be like, is it time to eat again yet? And that was, and one year literally made myself sick on chocolate oranges. My brother and I had our annual chocolate orange eating contest, which is just numbers of segments, not actual. People are like, how many chocolate oranges did you eat? I'm like, I was six. Segments. Now I reckon I could put away a couple. But
I think with a cup of tea. Yes.
Like at least one whole one, at least. But I just love the tradition of it and everything that I hold really dear. But then when I looked at, my mum would always be like, oh, Christmas. And I would be really mad at her. I'm like, why don't you love it as much as I do? And it's like, because Christmas for mums is so hard. Yeah. Like we ask so much of them. And it starts months earlier. It starts with the cards and the present buying and making plans for everybody and making sure all the food is in. And then there's the prep. And then the day itself is just exhausting and hard work and no one's really helping. And even if they offer to help, mum might be a bit of a martyr and say no, or you didn't really mean it anyway. And it really made me think about like all the terrible things I've done to my family. So the book is kind of an apology. But yeah, Christmas to me is just about having that really special time. And now my husband and I just stay home and we just the two of us. He works crazy hours. I work, God knows what I do. But it's like the one day that we're like, no, we're closing the door. We put records on in the morning. Nice. We open our presents. He calls his family. I text mine. I'm like, let's not speak. And we're all happier. And then we eat and then we drink and then we watch a film and then we drink. And then we do it again on Boxing Day.
Oh, sounds bloody lovely.
It's really lovely. It's really nice.
I get every year... I get older, believe it or not. Every year I think, I'll have more responsibility this Christmas. I'll do more when I probably, not saying it to myself like I will do more. I just sort of think it will naturally happen. Never does. Still just sitting on the sofa eating.
Yeah, you know, I just think we all revert back to who we were, unless we are forced to do otherwise.
Yeah, yeah. I genuinely think that is true. Mm. Are you a big Christmas fan, Beth?
I love Christmas.
Yes.
And listening to you talk, I was like, yeah, it's that sense that at Christmas things are special, even if they're things like sitting on the sofa. And what is that about? But one Christmas, my brother got in this habit of just calling everything the Christmas something. So he'd be like, can you pass the Christmas milk? Can you pass it? And there is an element of that, though, isn't there? It's like, yes, but this is Christmas chocolate.
Well, you've got to do the Christmas shop. I mean, I had to explain to my American husband why there were things in the cupboard that he could not touch for a month, because that's for Christmas, and why he will eat things that he does not enjoy, because it is Christmas. Yeah. And he really has had English Christmas forced upon him to the point now where he's like, are you going to bring back the dry roast peanuts that I like? And I was like, yes, but they're for Christmas. Yeah. And he's like, of course they are. So he's fully indoctrinated. I would bring him back now. He's trained up. He could do a proper Christmas now.
I broke into the cheese straws a little bit early one year and it was carnage.
Yeah. Absolute filth.
Absolute carnage.
I put the Quality Street out about a week before Christmas once, thinking it would just sit in a lovely dish on the table, and he ate them all. And can you imagine? Do you know how hard it is to get a tub of Quality Street in America?
I do, actually. Yeah. I genuinely
it's
do.
It's really hard and it's very expensive. Yeah. And he will literally never live that down. We will be in the old people's home and I'll be like, you don't touch him. Get your hands off
love my qualities. Yeah. Great.
But now I learn my lesson. They've got to stay in the cupboard, haven't they?
Yeah.
They've got to stay in the cupboard.
Too precious.
Yeah.
Also, if you can get a Christmas box, and I don't mean like something fancy, just like a smallish cardboard box that sits in the cupboard.
The Christmas box.
Because then the Christmas box. Because you can't then see the treats. You just see a boring old box.
Yes. I was going a very high cupboard above the sink that's a pain to get to. So Perfect. It all goes up there.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Well, this is, I mean, I love the fact that all these things are ringing true for all of us. It must be, I don't know, it's like...
I feel better about myself. I know that.
Well, as I said, I always like to ask my guests what they've been reading and enjoying recently. So it's just a little opportunity before we get to the book off to, I don't know, champion some new authors or some old authors or just a book that maybe hasn't been in the spotlight. You've been sort of darting around the country, Lindsay. Have you found any time to read at all?
What's going on?
Maybe on the plane?
I did read a little bit on the plane. I was reading a book because I'm doing an event in LA when I get back for the Christmas Wish with an author called Alicia Rye, who is a romance author who writes really fun romance. And she's written a book called Partners in Crime, I think is out here now. And it's a really fun romance America loves a trope. America loves reducing things to a trope, which is very helpful in a way. But it is a second chance romance of this couple that were together years ago and broke up for various reasons. And they end up like going on the run to Vegas and she's a lawyer or he's a lawyer. Or they're both lawyers. But it's very, very fun. And I was whizzing through that. I do have to keep a list of everything I've read or I can't
That's
remember.
That's a good idea. Why don't I do that?
Yeah, I have to do it. It's so bad. And I think so often as authors, we're reading stuff that's coming out in the future.
Mm.
So I'm always like, oh my God, you have to read this book. And they're like, it's not out till next year. You're massive.
I know. Yeah, thanks a lot.
Yeah. So it's hard. But I've read a lot of stuff that I love this year. I loved this book called The Change. I think it's Kristen Miller. I can't remember. Obsessed with that.
Mm-hmm.
I've been reading a lot of books about angry middle-aged women just killing people or like going Great. Off the... skip off. Yeah, I love it. I read Vladimir by, I think, Julia May Jones. So fantastic. So many good books this year. I was lucky enough to read The No Show last year.
You were telling everyone about it and they were like, it's not out till April 22.
Oh, it does not make you any friends to say you've already read it. People hate you. They hate you for it.
My dad keeps a little book journal.
Oh.
So he writes down what he's obviously the title of the author, and then he just, but not like essays, but just a little bit of like,
that's really
this
smart.
Is what I thought of it.
That's a great idea.
Just there you go.
Yeah, you think we would do something like that.
And you'd think I'd do it because he's told me about it and I've seen it and he says it's a really good thing to do. And I go, yeah. I've bought the journal to write it in 7 times.
Yeah, of course.
But I haven't bloody done it. What about you, Beth? What have you been reading and enjoying?
Just thinking as you were talking, I think the book that I've enjoyed the most in the last sort of few months is it's by an author called Amy Lee, who wrote Set on You, which was kind of blew up, I think. I haven't actually read that one. So this was my first of hers. It's called X's and O's. It's her second. Mm. And I loved it. It's so the heroine, Tara Chen, is like, she's just a totally unashamed, hopeless romantic. And that's one of the things that I loved most about it is she's the girl that kind of gets called crazy, you know, because she just expects a lot from love and she loves love stories and she wants big romance, and that's sort of what she's going after. So she goes back through the 10 kind of guys that she's dated, thinking like, can she create her own second chance romance and like find love by going backwards? But she has a very sexy flatmate. So he...
I hate when that happens.
Such a pain. That's so often the case in a romance novel. Yes.
And so rarely in real life.
And they just have the loveliest kind of... It's very slow burn. Mm. It's kind of... you know, they really become friends and get to know each other. And you know... No spoilers, but it is joyous. It would be a really fun one for kind of, you know, just like a cozying in book.
Mm, perfect for this time of year then.
Exactly.
Ideal. Thank you both for those recommendations.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring.
At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
And now it's time for another, because it's time for The Book Off, where each of you gets 3 minutes uninterrupted to tell us about a book that you love and you think that we should all read right away. Before we get to the books you've chosen, and indeed the pictures, a little bit of admin. The person who's travelled the furthest always gets to decide if they go first or second. That is definitely you. I mean, there's actually no question. So would you like to go first, or would you like to see what Beth's made of?
I will go second, purely because I've established I can't even pitch my own book. So I want to hear what Beth has to say, and then I'm going to copy her shamelessly.
Very good.
And go from there.
You also get an extra 3 minutes for sort of prep in
Fabulous.
Your mind as well.
Fabulous.
That's very clever. Well done. Which means, Beth, you get to decide whether at the three-minute mark you're honked out by the bicycle bell, or sorry, by the bicycle horn, or rung out by the school bell.
I like the school bell.
Do you?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, that's yours
Golden
then. Okay.
School bell.
So if you are still talking at 3 minutes,
yes.
You'll get the school bell. But if you bring it in under the wire, that's also fine as well. And Lindsay, you'll get a bit of the old bicycle.
Very
horn,
aggressive.
So.
Do we get like a 30-second warning, or am I?
Well, no, it's a very good and reasonable question.
The answer's going to be no.
I can give you a 30-second warning.
Go on.
Would you like that?
Yes, please.
I'm sure it'll really rate me, and then I'll.
Right.
So for the 30-second warning, I'm going to do this.
Oh, very nice.
All right.
We've got a new sound.
This is good, isn't it? I think someone's only ever asked for a 30-second warning once before on this podcast. We're in series 10.
I'd like to know where
I stand. So very good, very good. All right. Well, I'm putting 3 minutes on the clock then, Beth. And before we start the timer, why don't you tell us which book you're putting forward?
So it's Again, Rachel by Marion Keyes.
The fabulous. Wonderful Marianne Keyes, who was on this very podcast, sat in that very seat.
I feel so
recently.
Special.
Okay, 3 minutes on the clock then for you to tell us about Again, Rachel. Over to you.
So Again, Rachel is a sequel, actually, to Rachel's Holiday, which was published 25 years ago and is one of my favourite books. And it says how amazing this sequel is that I think it might be the first time I've ever loved a sequel more than the original book. Again, Rachel is about a woman called Rachel who's an addiction counsellor at the Cloisters, a rehab clinic where in Rachel's Holiday she was previously a patient. And you can definitely read this as a standalone as well. And when her ex-husband, Luke, returns to Ireland, her very settled, sorted life kind of starts to feel a little bit wobblier. I love this book. Sort of from in two different ways, I think. First, as a reader, and then as a writer. So, as a reader, like I just love how Marion writes character. The people in her books, they feel by the end like friends and family that you know. And every secondary character is just as fleshed out as the main ones, including in this novel the patients whose stories are sort of woven through Rachel's story, almost like little short stories within the novel, or like character sort of pieces within the novel. And to be able to get you to care about them, you know, when they have so little page time, I think it's just amazing. And also I love how she writes humour about such serious things. You know, this is a kind of comic novel in some ways set in rehab. You know, what an amazing thing to have done. And as a writer, I love like what skill and courage to come back to characters 25 years later, both in your life and theirs. And the thing that I love most about it is actually a spoiler, but I will talk around it and just say that there is a sort of trick that Marion plays on you in Rachel's Holiday. And she kind of almost plays it again in the second book. And I fell for it again. And I love the confidence to just come out and say, I'm going to do this again. And I'm going to do something really similar, actually. And once again, you're not going to guess and you're not going to see it coming. I just thought, wow, I have so much admiration for that. And I really think that in like 200 years, people will read Marion Keyes in the way that we read Jane Austen now. She, I think, is an absolute genius. And yeah, I think she's an extraordinary writer and that this might be her best book. I didn't even need my little 30 second warning.
There you go. Have a bit of that anyway.
Thanks.
You brought it in with 32 seconds to spare. I mean, you didn't need any warning. That was bad.
Thanks.
Absolutely brilliant. Right, take a breather. Have a sip of your water now.
I don't want to.
You're done. But you, Lindsay, have to step up to the plate. So just before we set the 3 minutes on your timer, what book are you putting forward?
I am going to tell you about Her Majesty's Royal Coven by Juno Dawson.
Oh, fabulous. Okay.
Yes.
Well, it's 3 minutes on the clock. Over to you.
Let's do it. So it's really hard for me, as Beth said, to switch off, I think, sometimes as a writer. And before I was a writer, I was an editor. So it's really, really difficult for me to just get lost in a book and not be picking it apart, which sounds awful, but just not to be involved in it in a structural sense. And I read Her Majesty's Royal Coven earlier this year and I was obsessed from the first page. And if you cut me open, I will bleed Buffy. There's Twilight in the marrow of my bones. I love fantasy, but I usually watch it on TV. I don't read that much fantasy, but this book just, it picked me up and I was done. I could not get enough of it. I've given it to so many friends. I've given it to so many different people who are also obsessed with it. I have the UK proof, I have the UK hardcover, and I have the American version because I am obsessed. So just know that I love this book and anything I say from here is from a place of love. But the book is about four friends. We meet them at their induction ceremony. They're about to take their oath to Gaia. They are witches. They live in the UK and we discover that underneath our everyday life, there is a coven of witches, Her Majesty's Royal Coven, who was founded by Anne Boleyn, and they have been helping protect the UK from magical forces and magical threats forever and ever. And these covens are all over the world. There is one in America as well that corresponds with fantastic acronyms. And we meet these four friends several years after there has been a civil war, a magic civil war, and we find them at different places in their life. Eleanor is the youngest head of the coven. We have Neve, who is living a quiet life as a vet, but she lost her fiancé and her sister during the civil war. And then we have Leonie, who has founded a new coven for witches who feel like they don't belong. And there is Elle, who is living a quiet life, pretending not to be a witch. Her husband doesn't know, her husband and kids. So all of these characters are in there. It is so wrapped up. I can't tell you because I don't have 18 years, but it is such clever storytelling. The characters are so fully realized and fleshed out and beautiful. Every single human being on earth is represented in this book, and it is done in such an elegant, fantastic way. If you love the world building and you know, witchy wizardness of perhaps some other series by someone else that is written more for children, but you love it as an adult or even as teenage Lindsay, like would have been obsessed with this. And I just cannot stress enough how wonderful it is. The story, the world building, how clever it is, what it says about our current society, but also while in this magical, fantastical realm. And I just love it. And it's the start of a series. So there's more to come. Imagine reading this and loving it this much and then finding out there's more to come. Please read it, everyone.
Whoa! 9 seconds to go.
Woo!
Nicely done.
Very nicely done, both of you. Two brilliant pictures. What an amazing selection of books. So, yes, a humble brag earlier, wasn't it? Marianne Keyes being on this podcast.
Loved it.
No,
amazing.
Big deal. Don't worry about it. And she was on to talk about, again, Rachel, because it was earlier this year. I loved everything you said there, Beth, because to come back to that character, which was so loved.
Amazing.
Right.
So brave.
You think, oh, is this a publishing decision, you know, or something like that? They thought, oh, come on, 25 years or whatever, let's go back. And actually, no, it was all her and done with such skill, as you say.
Amazing.
And I absolutely loved this. In 200 years, people will read Marion Keyes like we're reading Austen now. I mean, you don't think about that now, right? You don't think about people around now and so far in the future, but I think you might be right. You know?
She's a future classic, no question.
I just think so many of us owe our... I mean, I speak for myself, but I owe my career to Marianne. I read Watermelon when I was a teenager. Mm-hmm. My mum had it on holiday and I was as a... I was a voracious reader as a kid, and I would just read anything I get my hands on. And my mum had Watermelon, and I read it, and I read it in like a day. And I didn't know books could be like that. I was still coming out of YA / Flowers in the Attic, messed up kids. Yay, millennials. I loved it immediately, and I was a Marianne fan for life. And I just think if Marianne hadn't knocked that door down, you know, with Helen Fielding as well, with Bridget Jones, I don't know if contemporary women's fiction would be where it is now. I don't know if we would be allowed to write the books that we write.
And I think she's in your acknowledgements, Marianne, isn't she?
She is. She has been a massive champion of mine, and as well as an inspiration, and that there are not enough nice words for Marianne Keyes, which was why I felt rude even suggesting any other book, because the woman is a goddess and a queen, and I owe her so much, and just genuinely also a top person.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is madness.
Yeah. And everyone
loves her.
Everyone knows that, you know, we all love her. But this book in particular, I love that you've sort of singled this one out, Beth, and that it still kept you guessing.
Yeah.
You know, that she tricked you again.
Amazing.
25 years later. And you're so right about the, coming at it from a reader's point of view and a writer's point of view separately, as we do because of our professions. It's like, you do feel like they're friends. I think that's the case for almost all of her books as well, not just this one, but like you do actually sort of come away going, I know that, you know, I could speak to them.
Yeah. And when you close the book, you miss them. That feeling of like, oh, so basically she needs to keep writing sequels because I miss them all.
At least call you up every couple of weeks and let you know what they're doing.
Exactly what they're
up to. Is she all right though? Is she well? Is she keeping well? Has she had a tea?
Yeah,
is she all right? Has she got a scarf on? It's cold out.
Exactly. And then, I love Juno Dawson so much.
Another absolute goddess walking this planet.
Who's just has the span of the books that she's written as well, and the subjects she's tackled.
I don't think there's anything she can't do, which I actually take as a personal slight. It's upsetting.
But it's so true. And, you know, I haven't read this one. So is this quite new? Is this a new issue?
It's new this year.
Yeah.
And they just announced the date and everything for the sequel.
Of the sequel.
So, which is coming out next spring. So I think it was spring, summer. Yeah.
And as you say, isn't it amazing to read a book and then love it and know more is coming in that world.
It's the best feeling ever. Especially for the people I gave it to and said, you have to read this. Who then was like, I can't believe you gave me this with that ending. I'm like, the next one is coming.
But I think it's so great that I've literally underlined obsessed here, which is what you
obsessed.
Said. I love about that you gave it to so many people. Clever story. She's such a clever storyteller anyway. And the fact that it feels like it just has every, you know, it's so inclusive. Mm-hmm. There's a cast of characters and everything.
Yeah.
And you could read it as from whatever walk of life, and you're
absolutely,
you know,
and all the different ages too. It's something I didn't get in my pitch. I shouldn't add it now, but there's such an age range in the characters. Yeah. These women are sort of our age-ish, like in their 30s, 40s, and then you have an older generation that are advising them, and then you have their kids as well coming up. It's just so cleverly done. I don't know how she's so good at all the things. It's so upsetting.
So
I know, and she writes so fast, and she's so talented. And she's got great hair.
I am literally going to buy this book.
It's just like,
now.
Have one
like,
thing.
I'm going to leave here and buy this book. You've made me want to read it so much.
But I agree, but I think, Lizzie,
you're
the passion's
a great
pitcher.
You always say you're
through.
Not.
Oh, I just feel very strongly about this one. I feel very strongly about this one.
I mean, I think they both sound amazing. I have read the Marianne, I haven't read this Juno one. I think you've both pitched them exceptionally well. And I've got to take one home based on those brilliant pictures. Will Marianne ever forgive me? I think I'm going to take the Juno.
But Marianne is such an amazing person. Marianne would probably buy the Juno and send it to you.
She would.
The thing here. And it also feels unfair. Obviously, you've already had Marianne here and talked about the book, so I feel like...
I think that's a fair choice.
Yeah.
I think you're right. I don't think Marianne would mind. I think she'd be very encouraging of a different book.
So gracious.
But we should say that anyone who hasn't read Again, Rachel, or indeed read Marianne Keyes.
Yes.
What are you doing? Get out there. And what would you say? Because you did say, Beth, you can read it as a standalone. But if someone is listening and goes, oh, yeah, this Marianne Keyes that everyone keeps talking about, not read a book, would you go and read Rachel's Holiday?
I think I would, you know. Because, you know, why not read them all? So you might as well start with Rachel's Holiday. You're going, if you read Rachel's Holiday, you're going to read all of the Marion Keyes back catalogue.
Exactly, and I am going to get myself Her Majesty's Royal Coven.
Me too.
Immediately. Oh. In fact, me and Beth will probably be heading out to the...
I'll wrap up here.
Yeah.
I'll clear up the cups. You run down to
We're
the shop.
We're going to pop down to the local shop, because Junior Dawson is fab. And that was a wonderful and impassioned pitch, Lindsay. So very much look forward to reading that. So those are two great recommendations. And here are another two for you. The No Show by Beth O'Leary, which is out now, published by Quirkus, out in paperback, I believe, in February. And The Christmas Wish by Lindsay Kelk, also out now, published by HarperCollins. And what an absolute pleasure to have you both here and to chat. I think feel like we could just carry on, really, get another cup of tea and just natter away. But
I have no plans.
Thank you both for your time and your recommendations. It's been a real pleasure.
Oh, thanks so much for having us.
Yeah, thank you so much. This was so much fun.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.